Chapter 14. The Count of the Hill. My first orders as a freshly minted officer of the government were to head for the Comfort Inn in Warrenton, Virginia, a sad, dilapidated motel whose primary client was the State Department, by which I mean the CIA. It was the worst motel in a town of bad motels, which was probably why the CIA chose it. The fewer other guests, the lower the chances that anybody would notice that this particular Comfort Inn served as a makeshift dormitory for the Warrenton Training Center, or, as the folks who worked there call it, the Hill. When I checked in, the desk clerk warned me not to use the stairs, which were blocked off by police tape. I was given a room on the second floor of the main building, with a view of the inn's auxiliary buildings and parking lot. The room was barely lit. There was mold in the bathroom, the carpets were filthy with cigarette burns under the no-smoking sign, and the flimsy mattress was stained dark purple with what I hoped was booze. Nevertheless, I liked it. I was still at the age when I could find this seediness romantic, and I spent my first night lying awake in bed, watching the bugs swarm the single-domed overhead light fixture and counting down the hours to the free continental breakfast I'd been promised. The next morning, I discovered that on the continent of Warrenton, breakfast meant individual-sized boxes of Fruit Loops and sour milk. Welcome to the government. The Comfort Inn was to be my home for the next 6 months. My fellow inmates and I, as we called ourselves, were discouraged from telling our loved ones where we were staying and what we were doing. I leaned hard into those protocols, rarely heading back to Maryland or even talking to Lindsay on the phone. Anyway, we weren't allowed to take our phones to school, since class was classified, and we had classes all the time. Warrenton kept most of us too busy to be lonely. If the farm, down by Camp Peary, is the CIA's most famous training institution, chiefly because it's the only one that the agency's PR staff is allowed to talk to Hollywood about, the Hill is without a doubt the most mysterious. Connected via microwave and fiber optics to the satellite relay facility at Brandy Station, part of the Warrenton Training Center's constellations of sister sites, the Hill serves as the heart of the CIA's field communications network, carefully located just out of nuke range from D.C. The salty old techs who worked there like to say that the CIA could survive losing its headquarters to a catastrophic attack, but it would die if it ever lost Warrenton. And now that the top of the Hill holds two enormous top-secret data centers, one of which I later helped to construct, I'm inclined to agree. The Hill earned its name because of its location, which is atop, yes, a massive steepness. When I arrived, there was just one road that led in, past a purposely undermarked perimeter fence, and then up a grade so severe that whenever the temperature dropped and the road iced over, vehicles would lose traction and slide backward downhill. Just beyond the guarded checkpoint lies the State Department's decaying diplomatic communications training facility, whose prominent location was meant to reinforce its role as cover, making the Hill appear as if it's merely a place where the American Foreign Service trains its technologists. Beyond it, amid the back territory, were the various low, unlabeled buildings I studied in, and even farther on was the shooting range that the IC's trigger pullers used for special training. Shots would ring out in a style of firing I wasn't familiar with. Pop, pop, pop. Pop, pop, pop. A double tap meant to incapacitate, followed by an aimed shot meant to execute. I was there as a member of Class 6-06 of the BTTP, the Basic Telecommunications Training Program, whose intentionally beige name disguises one of the most classified and unusual curricula in existence. The purpose of the program is to train TISOs, Technical Information Security Officers, the CIA's cadre of elite communicators, or, less formally, COMO guys. A TISO is trained to be a jack-of-all-trades, a one-person replacement for previous generations' specialized roles of code clerk, radio man, electrician, mechanic, physical and digital security advisor, and computer technician. The main job of this undercover officer is to manage the technical infrastructure for CIA operations, most commonly overseas, at stations hidden inside American missions, consulates, and embassies, hence the State Department connection. The idea is, if you're in an American embassy, which is to say if you're far from home and surrounded by untrustworthy foreigners, whether hostiles or allies, they're still untrustworthy foreigners to the CIA, you're going to have to handle all of your technical needs internally. If you ask a local repairman to fix your secret spy base, he'll definitely do it, even for cheap. But he's also going to install hard-to-find bugs on behalf of a foreign power. As a result, TISOs are responsible for knowing how to fix basically every machine in the building, from individual computers and computer networks to CCTV and HVAC systems, solar panels, heaters and coolers, emergency generators, satellite hookups, military encryption devices, alarms, locks, and so on. The rule is that if it plugs in or gets plugged into, it's the TISO's problem. TISOs also have to know how to build some of these systems themselves, just as they have to know how to destroy them. When an embassy is under siege, say, after all the diplomats and most of their fellow CIA officers have been evacuated. The TISOs are always the last guys out. It's their job to send the final off-the-air message to headquarters after they've shredded, burned, wiped, degaussed, and disintegrated anything that has the CIA's fingerprints on it, from operational documents in safes to disks with cipher material, to ensure that nothing of value remains for an enemy to capture. Why this was a job for the CIA and not for the State Department, the entity that actually owns the embassy building, is more than the sheer difference in competence and trust. The real reason is plausible deniability. The worst-kept secret in modern diplomacy is that the primary function of an embassy nowadays is to serve as a platform for espionage. The old explanations for why a country might try to maintain a notionally sovereign physical presence on another country's soil faded into obsolescence with the rise of electronic communications and jet-powered aircraft. Today, the most meaningful diplomacy happens directly between ministries and ministers. Sure, embassies do still send the occasional démarché to help support their citizens abroad, and then there are the consular sections that issue visas and renew passports. But those are often in a completely different building, and anyway, none of those activities can even remotely justify the expense of maintaining all that infrastructure. Instead, what justifies the expense is the ability for a country to use the cover of its foreign service to conduct and legitimize its spying. TISOs work under diplomatic cover with credentials that hide them among these foreign service officers, usually under the identity of attachés. The largest embassies would have maybe 5 of these people. The larger embassies would have maybe 3, but most just have 1. They're called singletons. And I remember being told that of all the posts the CIA offers, these have the highest rate of divorce. To be a singleton is to be the lone technical officer far from home in a world where everything is always broken. My class in Warrenton began with around 8 members and lost only 1 before graduation, which I was told was fairly uncommon. And this motley crew was uncommon too, though pretty well representative of the kind of malcontents who voluntarily sign up for a career track that all but guarantees they'll spend the majority of their service undercover in a foreign country. For the first time in my IC career, I wasn't the youngest in the room. At age 24, I'd say I was around the mean, though my experience doing systems work at headquarters certainly gave me a boost in terms of familiarity with the agency's operations. Most of the others were just tech-inclined kids straight out of college or straight off the street who'd applied online. In a nod to the paramilitary aspirations of the CIA's foreign field branches, we called each other by nicknames, quickly assigned based on eccentricities more often than by our true names. Taco Bell was a suburb, wide, likable, and blank. At 20 years old, the only job he'd had prior to the CIA was as the night shift manager at a branch of the eponymous restaurant in Pennsylvania. Rain Man was in his late 20s and spent the term bouncing around the autism spectrum between catatonic detachment and shivering fury. He wore the name we gave him proudly and claimed it was a Native American honorific. Flute earned his name because his career in the Marines was far less interesting to us than his degree in panpipes from a music conservatory. Spo was one of the older guys, at 35 or so. He was called what he was called because he'd been an SPO, a special police officer at the CIA's headquarters, where he got so bored out of his mind guarding the gate at McLean that he was determined to escape overseas, even if it meant cramming his entire family into a single motel room, a situation that lasted until the management found his kid's pet snake living in a dresser drawer. Our elder was the colonel, a mid-40s former Special Forces Camus sergeant who, after numerous tours in the sandbox, was trying out for his second act. We called him the colonel, even though he was just an enlisted guy, not an officer, mostly out of his resemblance to that friendly Kentuckian whose fried chicken we preferred to the regular fare of the Warrenton cafeteria. My nickname, I guess I can't avoid it, was the Count. Not because of my aristocratic bearing or dandyish fashion sense, but because, like the felt vampire puppet of Sesame Street, I had a tendency to signal my intention to interrupt class by raising my forefinger, as if to say, 1, 2, 3, three things you forgot. These were the folks with whom I'd cycle through some 20 different classes, each in its own specialty, but most having to do with how to make the technology available in any given environment serve the government of the United States, whether in an embassy or on the run. One drill involved lugging the off-site package, which was an 80-pound suitcase of communications equipment that was older than I was, up onto a building's roof. With just a compass and a laminated sheet of coordinates, I'd have to find in all that vast sky of twinkling stars one of the CIA's stealth satellites, which would connect me to the agency's mothership, its Crisis Communications Center in McLean, call sign Central. And then I'd use the Cold War-era kit inside the package to establish an encrypted radio channel. This drill was a practical reminder of why the COMO officer is always the first in and last out. The chief of station can steal the deepest secret in the world, but it doesn't mean squat until somebody gets it home. That night, I stayed on base after dark and drove my car up to the very top of the hill, parking outside the converted barn where we studied electrical concepts meant to prevent adversaries from monitoring our activities. The methods we learned about at times seemed close to voodoo, such as the ability to reproduce what's being displayed on any computer monitor by using only the tiny electromagnetic emissions caused by the oscillating currents in its internal components, which can be captured using a special antenna, a method called Van Eck freaking. If this sounds hard to understand, I promise we all felt the same way. The instructor himself readily admitted that he never fully comprehended the details and couldn't demonstrate it for us, but he knew the threat was real. The CIA was doing it to others, which meant others could do it to us. I sat on the roof of my car, that same old white Civic, and as I gazed out over what felt like all of Virginia, I called Lindsay for the first time in weeks, or even a month. We talked until my phone's battery died, my breath becoming visible as the night got colder. There was nothing I wanted more than to share the scene with her. The dark fields, the undulating hills, the high astral shimmer. But describing it to her was the best I could do. I was already breaking the rules by using my phone. I would have been breaking the law by taking a picture. One of Warrenton's major subjects of study involved how to service the terminals and cables, the basic, in many ways, the primitive components of any CIA station's communications infrastructure. A terminal, in this context, is just a computer used to send and receive messages over a single secure network. In the CIA, the word cables tends to refer to the messages themselves, but technical officers know that cables are also far more tangible. They're the cords or wires that, for the last half century or so, have linked the agency's terminals, specifically its ancient post-communication terminals, all over the world, tunneling underground across national borders, buried at the bottom of the ocean. Ours was the last year that TISOs had to be fluent in all of this, the terminal hardware, the multiple software packages, and the cables too, of course. For some of my classmates, it felt a bit crazy to have to deal with issues of insulation and sheathing in what was supposed to be the age of wireless. But if any of them voiced doubts about the relevance of any of the seemingly antiquated tech that we were being taught, our instructors would remind us that ours was also the first year in the history of the Hill that TISOs weren't required to learn Morse code. Closing in on graduation, we had to fill out what were called dream sheets. We were given a list of the CIA stations worldwide that needed personnel, and were told to rank them in the order of our preferences. These dream sheets then went to the requirements division, which promptly crumpled them up and tossed them in the trash, at least according to rumor. My dream sheet started with what was called the SRD, the Special Requirements Division. This was technically a posting not at any embassy, but here in Virginia, from which I would be sent out on periodic tours of all the uglier spots in the sandbox, places where the agency judged a permanent posting too harsh or too dangerous. Tiny, isolated forward operating bases in Afghanistan, Iraq, and the border regions of Pakistan, for example. By choosing SRD, I was opting for challenge and variety over being stuck in just one city for the entire duration of what was supposed to be an up to 3-year stint. My instructors were all pretty confident that SRD would jump at the chance to bring me on, and I was pretty confident in my newly honed abilities. But things didn't quite go as expected. As was evident from the condition of the Comfort Inn, the school had been cutting some corners. Some of my classmates had begun to suspect that the administration was actually, believe it or not, violating federal labor laws. As a work-obsessed recluse, I initially wasn't bothered by this, nor was anyone around my age. For us, this was the sort of low-level exploitation we'd experienced so often that we already mistook it for normal. But unpaid overtime, denied leave, and refusals to honor family benefits made a difference to the older classmates. The colonel had alimony payments, and Spo had a family. Every dollar counted. Every minute mattered. These grievances came to a head when the decrepit stairs at the Comfort Inn finally collapsed. Luckily, no one was injured, but everyone was spooked, and my classmates started grumbling that if the building had been bankrolled by any entity other than the CIA, it would have been condemned for fire code violations years ago. The discontent spread, and soon enough, what was basically a school for saboteurs was close to unionizing. Management, in response, dug in its heels and decided to wait us out, since everybody involved eventually had to either graduate or be fired. A few of my classmates approached me. They knew that I was well-liked by the instructors, since my skills put me near the top of my class. They were also aware, because I'd worked at headquarters, that I knew my way around the bureaucracy. Plus, I could write pretty well, at least by tech standards. They wanted me to act as a sort of class representative, or class martyr, by formally bringing their complaints to the head of the school. I'd like to say that I was motivated to take on this cause solely by my aggrieved sense of justice. But while that certainly did factor into the decision, I can't deny that for a young man who was suddenly excelling at nearly everything he attempted, challenging the school's crooked administration just sounded like fun. Within an hour, I was compiling policies to cite from the internal network, and before the day was done, my email was sent. The next morning, the head of the school had me come into his office. He admitted the school had gone off the rails, but said the problems weren't anything he could solve. You're only here for 12 more weeks. Do me a favor and just tell your classmates to suck it up. Assignments are coming up soon, and then you'll have better things to worry about. All you'll remember from your time here is who had the best performance review. What he said had been worded in such a way that it might have been a threat, and it might have been a bribe. Either way, it bothered me. By the time I left his office, the fun was over, and it was justice I was after. I walked back into a class that had expected to lose. I remember Spo noticing my frown and saying, "Don't feel bad, man, at least you tried." He'd been at the agency longer than any of my other classmates. He knew how it worked and how ludicrous it was to trust management to fix something that management itself had broken. I was a bureaucratic innocent by comparison, disturbed by the loss and by the ease with which Spo and the others accepted it. I hated the feeling that the mere fiction of process was enough to dispel a genuine demand for results. It wasn't that my classmates didn't care enough to fight, it was that they couldn't afford to. The system was designed so that the perceived cost of escalation exceeded the expected benefit of resolution. At age 24, though, I thought as little of the costs as I did of the benefits. I just cared about the system. I wasn't finished. I rewrote and resent the email, not to the head of the school now, but to his boss, the director of Field Service Group. Though he was higher up the totem pole than the head of the school, the DFSG was pretty much equivalent in rank and seniority to a few of the personnel I dealt with at headquarters. Then I copied the email to his boss, who definitely was not. A few days later, we were in a class on something like false subtraction as a form of field expedient encryption, when a front office secretary came in and declared that the old regime had fallen. Unpaid overtime would no longer be required, and effective in 2 weeks, we were all being moved to a much nicer hotel. I remember the giddy pride with which she announced, "A Hampton Inn!" I had only a day or so to revel in my glory before class was interrupted again. This time, the head of the school was at the door, summoning me back to his office. Spo immediately leaped from his seat, enveloping me in a hug, mimed wiping away a tear, and declared that he'd never forget me. The head of the school rolled his eyes. There, waiting in the school head's office, was the director of the field service group, the school head's boss, the boss of nearly everyone on the TISO career track, the boss whose boss I'd emailed. He was exceptionally cordial and didn't project any of the school head's clenched jaw irritation. This unnerved me. I tried to keep a calm exterior, but inside I was sweating. The head of the school began our chat by reiterating how the issues the class had brought to light were in the process of being resolved. His superior cut him off. "But why we're here is not to talk about that. Why we're here is to talk about insubordination and the chain of command." If he'd slapped me, I would have been less shocked. I had no idea what the director meant by insubordination. But before I had the opportunity to ask, he continued. "The CIA was quite different from the other civilian agencies," he said, "even if on paper the regulations insisted it wasn't. And in an agency that did such important work, there was nothing more important than the chain of command." Raising a forefinger, automatically but politely, I pointed out that before I emailed above my station, I'd tried the chain of command and been failed by it, which was precisely the last thing I should have been explaining to the chain of command itself, personified just across a desk from me. The head of the school just stared at his shoes and occasionally glanced out the window. "Listen," his boss said. "Ed, I'm not here to file a hurt feelings report. Relax. I recognize that you're a talented guy, and we've gone around and talked to all of your instructors, and they say you're talented and sharp, even volunteered for the war zone. That's something we appreciate. We want you here, but we need to know that we can count on you. You've got to understand that there's a system here. Sometimes we've all got to put up with things we don't like because the mission comes first, and we can't complete that mission if every guy on the team is second-guessing." He took a pause, swallowed, and said, "Nowhere is this more true than in the desert. A lot of things happen out in the desert. And I'm not sure that we're at a stage yet where I'm comfortable you'll know how to handle them." This was their gotcha, their retaliation. And though it was entirely self-defeating, The head of the school was now smiling at the parking lot. No one besides me, and I mean no one, had put down SRD, or any other active combat situation for that matter, as their first or second or even third choice on their dream sheets. Everyone else had prioritized all the stops on the European champagne circuit, all the neat, sweet vacation station burgs with windmills and bicycles where you rarely hear explosions. Almost perversely, they now gave me one of these assignments. They gave me Geneva. They punished me by giving me what I'd never asked for, but what everybody else had wanted. As if you were reading my mind, the director said, "This isn't a punishment, Ed. It's an opportunity. Really. Someone with your level of expertise would be wasted in the war zone. You need a bigger station that pilots the newest projects to really keep you busy and stretch your skills." Everybody in class who'd been congratulating me would later turn jealous and think that I'd been bought off with a luxury position to avoid further complaints. My reaction in the moment was the opposite. I thought that the head of the school must have had an informant in the class who told him exactly the type of station I'd hoped to avoid. The director got up with a smile, which signaled that the meeting was over. "All right, I think we've got a plan. Before I leave, I just want to make sure we're clear here. I'm not going to have another Ed Snowden moment, am I?"